Okay, we're talking about the 2300 days and years. Look about a little parenthetical study. This is of parenthetical interest. It's the Millerite Adventist year-day theory. Seventh-day Adventism, a key date in Seventh-day Adventism is 1844. As you know, William Miller taught that in 1844 the Lord was coming back. The Lord, as he is wont to do, did not show up on schedule. So Miller went out of the prophecy business, but one of his followers, Ellen White, picked up on his charts and said the Lord did come in 1844, but he didn't come to earth. He came to another part of heaven and began the investigative judgment. And those who followed her in this, we know as Seventh-day Adventists. She's the prophetess of Seventh-day Adventism. Now, where did Miller get this 1844 date, which is a key date in Adventism? That's what this little study is for. They simply count 2300 years. A day equals a year. Where do they get this? Where does this year, what scripture is used to justify the year-day theory?
A year to the Lord is like a day, and a day is like a year.
Be like a thousand years, that kind of thing.
Well,
there's no scripture that says that. They simply say a year, a day equals a year. So they said, well, when Daniel asked when the question is asked, how long is the sanctuary going to be defiled? 2300 years. It counts 2300 years from the decree of Artaxerxes in 457. Arise at the date of 1844. Now that's how that date came. You can see that's a Seventh-day Adventist chart. That little chart came from a Seventh-day Adventist book. Now, I just put that in for your...
Lord, what about the Psalms for 1,000 years in your sight?
Nice try, though. Well, you make a lot of Adventists. Now, we come to verse 15 of chapter 8, just to sort of finish up here. And it came about that when I, Daniel, had seen the vision and sought to understand it, behold, standing before me was one who looked like a man. And I heard the voice of a man between the banks of Uli, that's this canal. And he called out and said, Gabriel, give this man an understanding of the vision. So who was this man? Well, a part of the vision at least. Gabriel is one of the two angels that are named in the Bible. Who's the other angel that's named in the Bible? Michael. These are two very important angels, obviously. And Daniel is the only book in the Old Testament in which angels are given their personal names. Gabriel appears elsewhere in the Bible. Where? One of the places. Yes. What was the angel that came to Mary? The angel of Gabriel. Is it not? Yes. So she says, it says, Gabriel, give this man an understanding of the vision. So he came near to where I was standing. And when I came, I was frightened and fell on my face. And he said to me, Son of man, understand that the vision pertains to the time of the end. That is the end of what? The end of the Old Testament age, certainly not the end of all time. The end of indignation began with Babylonian rule, shall end with Antiochus. Probably the other, probably means the latter. That is, he's saying, when is all this indignation going to end that the people of God are suffering? Well, the vision pertains to that. Now, while he was talking to me, I sank into a deep sleep with my face to the ground. But he touched me and made me stand upright. And he said, behold, which probably means he fainted. passed out. But he revived. Give me smelling salts. Pick me up. He said, behold, I'm going to let you know what will occur at the final period of the indignation, for it pertains to the appointed time of the end. The ram, and then he interprets it. And we've already interpreted this, so we won't spend a lot of time on this. The ram which you saw with the two horns represents the kings of Media and Persia. The shaggy goat represents the kingdom of Greece. The large horn that is between his eyes is the first king. And the broken horn and the four horns that arose in its place represent four kingdoms which shall arise from this his nation, although not with his power. In the latter period of their rule, when the transgressors have run their course, a king will arise, this is Antiochus Epiphanes, insolent and skilled in intrigue. And his power will be mighty, but not by his own power. That is, God granted him this power to, look at the syllabus, to punish his people. He will destroy to an extraordinary degree and prosper and perform his will, destroy mighty men and the holy people. This is this persecution we've talked about. And through his shrewdness, he will cause deceit to succeed by his influence. He will magnify himself in his heart and destroy many while they are at ease. His shrewdness, he was. He made false treaties, used lies. He was a born diplomat. He opposed the prince of princes, verse 25. That's God. He'll be broken without human agency. God is going to take care of him, the judgment of God. We looked at that. And the visions of the evenings and mornings, that is the sacrifices, which has been told is true. But keep the vision secret, for it pertains to many days in the future. Well, it happened for a while. Then Daniel was exhausted. And sick for days. Then I, Daniel, was exhausted and sick for days. Then I got up again and carried on the king's business, but I was astounded at the vision, and there was none to explain it. Any questions on chapter 8? Chronological, and this took place with Belshazzar. Now we move to Daniel chapter 5.
Yes. When you, those times you watch Church of God or something like that, then you consider it a bigger deal and all this stuff. They talk about verse 26 as the fact that it was sealed up until Armstrong came along. Nobody knew the answer. He was the one who knew the answer. I mean, he was the one they opened the seals to. I notice, could you just comment on your letter G out here? In the sense of preserving the vision of not knowing the truth of sin. Because many, many cults and just people believe, just use that as, you know, it's been sealed up. And
well, this phrase, it's a good point. Here's what it means. This phrase, close the book or seal the book, the time is not yet. We're going to find this also at the end of the book, at the end of the whole book. Flip over to Daniel chapter 12. Now, we'll come back to this. But I'll answer the question here since you raise it here. Look at Daniel 12. Nine. He said, go your way, Daniel, for these words are concealed and sealed up until the end time. Same thing. Not the exact word, the same thing. Now here's what that means. It's a time indicator. He's saying, look, seal up the vision and prophecy. How's he word this? Keep the vision secret, seal it up, for it pertains to many days in the future. He's not saying, don't. It's a vast secret. It's a time indicator. It's an idiomatic way of saying, look, close the book. Why? Because these things aren't. This 2,300 days. This 2,300 days. What he's talking about in particular, mornings and evenings. I wasn't going to take question 167. It's indicating that this is going to be fulfilled long after you're dead. A lot of years are going to pass. It's way down the road. It's an indication of, it's a time indicator. Now you see the opposite of this, students, in the book of Revelation. The book of Revelation picks up on this language but reverses it, which in my opinion is one of, which I use as one of the keys to interpreting, to indicate the character of the book of Revelation, where he says, don't close the book, for the time is at hand. Close the book, the time is not yet, in Daniel. Don't close the book, the time is at hand. That's one of the reasons why I reject a futurist interpretation of the book of Revelation. Greg Fevers says, this what you have seen, John, is not going to happen way down 10 centuries from now. Don't even close the book. Why? These things are happening right now. I use the preterist or historical approach to the Revelation for that and many other reasons. It's a very clear statement.
Which is one of Armstrong's favorites. Yeah. He did last to his TV program. He shows his pictures. The book's been open to me. Now I'll tell you.
That's not, but you understand, that's not what it meant. It was a, not saying it's going to take some mystical prophet to, or some mystical process or a prophet to, but simply indicating the time. You understand his question and my answer? Okay. Well, now we get to an easy part again. Well, let me say this before I leave chapter 8. There's a tradition in Josephus, and I mentioned it earlier, that in the introductory work, that Josephus tells how that the priests in Jerusalem saved the city from destruction by Alexander the Great by meeting him and reading the book of Daniel to him and showing, well, look, our prophet. Which is probably not true. But that eight is, that's what they read to him. This Prince of Greece, who shall come? And the tradition. Well. Okay. Now we come to Belshazzar's feast and the fall of Babylon. And this is one of the most fabulous chapters in the whole Bible. It's my favorite chapter in the book of Daniel. It's the easiest to teach. The last chapter was the pits. The last chapter was reasonably difficult. Chapter 9 is going to be the toughie. Chapters, anyway. This is easy to teach, and it is dramatic. And it's one of the stories you learn in Vacation Bible School. If you can forget the flannel graph approach. First of all, look at the chronology. Belshazzar, the king, held a great feast for 1,000 of his nobles, and he was drinking wine in the presence of 1,000. Now, we look at the chronology and the identity of Belshazzar, the syllabus. First of all, this was his last year, so we know very well it's 539 B.C. Babylon fell, but his last year was the last year of Babylon. The last year of Babylon was 538, 539 by our calendar. You understand, don't you, why we say that? Because the years don't begin and end the same time as our years begin and end. Okay, now, here's an example of where archaeology, and I didn't talk about this yet, I'm sure I did, where archaeology and both illumines and verifies scripture. The primary contribution of archaeology to biblical studies is not verification. The primary contribution, that is, it's not a question whether it's true or false. The primary contribution is illumination. It fills in the background. Now here's a case where you have both illumination and verification. According to the book of Daniel, the last king of Babylon is Belshazzar. The problem is, according to Herodotus and Xenophon, who came along in the 4th century, the 5th century, I'm sorry, the last king of Babylon was Nabonidus. When the Cananeans, and so the critics said, well, you see, and nobody had heard of Belshazzar. Who was king of Babylon when it fell? Herodotus says Nabonidus. Daniel says Belshazzar. Well, the critic said, who was Belshazzar? Well, that's a name that one of the editors, Daniel was not written by Daniel, if Daniel ever lived. And what was Daniel's name? Belteshazzar? It was a confusion of his name. The Bible's wrong. You can still buy old books, say that. And then the cuneiform records begin to come out. The king list, the Babylonian king list. And who did the Babylonian king list as the last king of Babylon? Nabonidus. No mention of Belshazzar. Aha! Another confirmation that the Bible is wrong. Critics had a high old time with that. Wrote several books in which they said that. And because neither the king list did not mention anybody named Belshazzar. And the Greek historians who told about the fall of Babylon did not mention Belshazzar. Now, and then all of a sudden things begin to change. A cuneiform record, not one of the king lists, came out. It's called the Persian verse account of Nabonidus. That's what it's called. Nabonidus, of course, says, entrusted the kingship to his son Belshazzar. All of a sudden Belshazzar appears in the cuneiform records, contemporary cuneiform records. And guess who he is? Well, it said, the Persian verse account says that Belshazzar, all it says is that Nabonidus entrusted kingship to his son Belshazzar, but didn't say why. And then a record called the Haran inscription. Haran is in modern Syria. And earlier in this century, this is fabulous. This is a find that came by accident. They're rebuilding a mosque, tearing down an old mosque anyway. And the step and the front step had been worn concave by the years of traffic. And in the process of demolishing this old mosque, they turned that step over. And lo and behold, it was a stele. It's an ancient Babylonian, like a signpost, inscriptions put up by kings to announce certain things, tell stories as information, communication. The stele, that's called the Haran inscription because it's found in Haran. And guess what it said? Tell the story, and now we understand. Here's where archaeology, first of all, with the book of Daniel, as this picture comes together, that Nabonidus, notice how this all dovetails. Why are they having a feast, Belshazzar's feast? We'll come back to this, but learn this. It was a revival meeting. They were trying to encourage the gods, in particular Marduk, to do again what they had done before, and that is make Babylon great. Why did they meet? They had obviously fallen into disfavor. Why? Well, the Persians had taken the outlying cities, and the Persians were marching on Babylon, even though it would take them years to take it, normally. Secondly, so the kingdom was disintegrating. There was a drought. The rivers were low, and the crops didn't come in. So what they were doing was they were, and Babylon had been suffering bad times for several years. This was a revival meeting. We'll talk about that later. Nabonidus, who was the king, who was the chief god, which god was the chief god of Babylon? Marduk. One of the lesser gods was the moon god Sin. Nabonidus had been raised by his mother, who was a priestess of the moon god Sin. This is what comes out of this Haran inscription, and it's all fit together. And his mother had taught him that the true chief god of Babylon should be Sin, S-I-N, not heard. To be seen, not Marduk. And Nabonidus said to the priesthood of Babylon, the priesthood was the most powerful force in Babylon, priesthood of Marduk, said to them, the reason we're having all this trouble, while the Persians are taking our cities, and the rain isn't falling, the river's low, and there's drought, is because we are not elevating the right God. But he could not, but the priests, and he suspended, hear me, he suspended the New Year's, the biggest holiday in the year in Babylon, the New Year's festival, during which the king would go to the temple of Marduk, grasp the horns of Marduk, the horns of the altar, and be invested with kingship for another year. He had suspended that. Why? But the priesthood was too powerful for him, and so he left Babylon. He was gone from 10 to 12 years. He went out to Tema, which is out in the desert, to the east, northeast, I think it's northeast, it's east, which was an oasis. Tema was an oasis town that was a cult center for Sin, the moon god, that his mother had taught him to elevate above Marduk. You got that? What he's doing, he's out there pouting. He's out there saying, look, when you come to your senses and elevate the right god, then the fortunes of Babylon will once again turn to the good. But until you come to your senses, I'm not coming back. And before he left, he invested kingship. He left in the office of king, although he was not actually the king on the king list, his son Belshazzar. Isn't it interesting? The Bible was right, and the critics were wrong. Again, you think they get tired of being wrong, but they never seem to tire of it. And so, note this. Now, let me teach you something. Here you see the critic's argument gets reversed on itself. If Daniel, if you ask anybody in the 2nd century B.C., which was after the Greeks had written, who was the last king of Babylon, the answer automatically would have been Nabonidus. Everybody knew he was the last king of Babylon. But Daniel was there. You kind of had to be there to know. But as a matter of fact, the king, the fellow who was actually the functioning king in Babylon when the Persians came, was not Nabonidus at all. It was Belshazzar. You see what I'm saying? Anybody writing in the 2nd century B.C. when the critics put the writing of Daniel would have put Nabonidus. There's no doubt about it. But Daniel is not a 2nd century document. It's a 6th century document. And it's written by a 6th century man named Daniel who was there. And he got it right. Note this. The Greeks, Herodotus was not there. He came along in the next century and he missed it. Technically he was right. All he had were the king lists. You know, he just gave the official count. Who was the last king of Babylon? I think that's fabulous. Now we return to the revival. Remember I taught you going in chapter 1, the significance of the vessels in the temple, and I said we're going to see them again. Now this is dramatic. When Belshazzar tasted the wine, he was drinking wine in the presence of the thousand. Now that is the thousand of his nobles. Now listen to me. That was not a count. There were many more than a thousand. That came to be, it's like the word legion, the Romans, which was not a count. That meant his thousands. That was an idiomatic way of saying his military staff, his joint chiefs, the military staff, which have been many of them. When Belshazzar tasted the wine, he gave orders to bring the gold and silver vessels which Nebuchadnezzar, his father, or his ancestor, should be understood, had taken out of the temple, which was in Jerusalem, in order that the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines, might drink from them. Then they brought the gold vessels that had been taken out of the temple, the house of God, which was in Jerusalem, and the king and his nobles and his wives and his concubines drank from them. Now look at this. They drank the wine, verse 4 is critical, and what? Praised the gods of gold and silver, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone. What is going on? Why did they get the vessels from the temple and drink from them? Well, the dishwasher broke down. Or quit. No, they were not short on dishes. What were they doing? What was going on? See, it was a revival meeting, as I've already said. They were trying to court the gods of Babylon, especially Marduk, saying, what have we done to offend you? We're sorry. They probably told Marduk that they apologized for what Nabonidus had said about him. And the way they would do is, remember I said that the ancient Near Eastern concept was, if my city conquered your city, that meant my God is stronger than your God. And they would signify this by bringing the statue and putting it at the feet of the conquering God as the tabernacle was taken to the house of Dagon, the Philistines. You recall my discussion of that. And it was an insult. Your God sits at the feet of our God. Our God uses your God for a footstool. Your God exists. It's just he's the footstool for my God. And here's what they did, you guys. In this feast, which lasted several days. And by the way, Herodotus says when Babylon fell, there was a feast going on, a festival going on. And it was this Belshazzar's feast. What they were doing is they would bring in the statuary of their gods from the temple with great pomp and ceremony, bring them into the banquet hall, and then they would bring the statues of the conquered gods and they would parade them back and forth at the feet of their god, and they would spit on them and mock them and ridicule them and curse them. saying, this is how we treat your enemies. And so, and they wanted to do, and the God of Israel had to come in for his turn, except that was the problem with the God of Israel. Never had a statue. What's the closest thing they had? The vessels in the temple, which had been sitting at the feet of Marduk all these years. So they bring them in, and they insult the God of Israel by using them as common tableware. They're drinking. That's what verse 4 means. Drink the wine and praise the gods of silver, gold, gold and silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. They are insulting the God of Israel. They are cursing him, mocking him. You understand that? They were doing exactly the same thing as when they brought the statues of the conquered gods and spit on them and ridiculed them to elevate and court their own god. Except this God shows up. I think this is dramatic. So here they are, hurling, saying filthy things about the God of Israel, the God of the children of Israel. And we'll tell what they were doing with those vessels in the temple. And then what happens? It says, suddenly the fingers of a man's hand emerged and began writing opposite the lampstand on the plaster wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the back of the hand of his writing. Now I put this to the syllabus. I'm going to use my thank you very large. If you can see this or not. This is in your syllabus, as you note, so you could have a record of it. This is the archaeologists have dug up Nebuchadnezzar's palace in his throne room. And here's what they found. Here, what it was, there was a series of banquet. This was a large banquet hall. You can see the dimensions on it. The 197 feet by 180. They were probably having a banquet. This is probably what the main banquet hall was. Y'all see that? Number three. And what it was, there was a raised area at this end. It's like you would have a large room, and on one end there would be like a platform area, steps going up to it, and up there on that platform level was where the king sat with his queen and his family, the La-di-da people, sat up there on this platform, which was right up here. And interestingly enough, it says in Daniel that the king's hand wrote on the plaster opposite the lampstand. Now, you see what it says? Opposite the lampstand. The archaeologists found that the walls, all the walls that are around here, these are all rooms where people live, he's having an intimate gathering of several hundred of his top people of the kingdom, praising their God. And they found that the walls were highly decorated, as the ancient Near Eastern people did. You've seen pictures in archaeology books, lions, except for this wall, the back wall, which was white plaster, nothing on it. Why? Probably because to reflect the light. Because the huge lamp that sits somewhere near the front part of the platform, they probably left that blank because it would be so dark up there, and the white wall, it would increase the light. I can't be sure about that. This is a guess, probably for light. But you understand? There's some reason for leaving it blank. That's as good a guess as any. Now, here they are, but you see the scene? Well, here's all the people sitting out here, carousing and drinking and insulting the God of Israel. Up here on the platform, they're drinking out of the vessels from the temple. And all of a sudden, the man's hand appears and begins to write on this white, flat white wall that's been left for them. For him to write on, blank tablet. Now, let's see where I am. Okay, the handwriting on the wall. God of Israel is being insulted, and he shows up. Now, I'll give you the sources of information on the royal palace. That's what this is here. Now, the hand appears and writes, we're on page 35 now.
And the king's face grew pale, and his thoughts alarmed him, and his hip joints went slack, and his knees began knocking together. Can you imagine this? Here's how I picture it. Now, I can't prove this is right, but you can take my word for it. This is exactly how it happened. Here's this huge room. Up here's the platform. And they're all ringing and crowding. You know how loud these parties are. And all this, and here's the God didn't say a word. They were insulting him and they're saying, you know, our God has conquered God Yahweh. And all of a sudden, Yahweh turned to Christ. And the first person who saw it, the king's got his back to it, probably. He's sitting there. Feasted, you know. The first person who saw it, noticed the person next to him, which is happening. And the word spreads. And so as the word spreads, a huge banquet hall, it gradually gets quiet. Can you imagine that the last person to see it still laughing? You know, some girl sitting on the fellow's lap, way back in the corner. She's still who the problem, you know, she's the last. You ever the last one to get quiet in the crowd? And the king, as it begins to quiet down, Belshazzar, you know, got his hand on the vessels of the temple. What's everybody's thought? Everybody's pointing. He turns around. There it is. His hand hangs suspended in midair, writing on his wall. And it says his knees. He felt. It says here his knees knocked together. His knees began knocking. His hip joints went slack. Well, hip joint. That means he was standing up. He was leading the chorus. Hail Marduk, you know. You know, 3-4 times. Whatever the song is, and all of a sudden he falls back on his couch. He climbed on couches. His hip joints, but he couldn't stand up anymore. And the king called aloud to bring in the conjurers. Here's the same outfit. Same bunch. Chaldeans and diviners, his advisors. What's what they get? Says, boys, come and earn your money. It's what you get paid for. Any man who could read this inscription and explain its interpretation to me would be clothed with purple and have a necklace of gold around his neck. And have authority and get as a third ruler of the kingdom. Now that does not mean, we know now, he does not mean third in line. He means ruler of a third. Under him, ruler of a third of the kingdom. Then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the inscription or make one's interpretation to the king. Now, does it mean that, why could they not read the writing? On top of page 36, I give you the alternatives.
Yes. I've used this scripture, I guess, wrongly. I'm sure a lot of people have to show that back on the last sacrament of the seven. To show that, yes, this supports this whole theory that Belshazzar was second, was like lieutenant governor, and that whoever was going to be the third, not the second. I've heard that. I know I've used it. I know a lot of people.
It says on commentary, it's not true.
No.
Third ruler would have been the third of the kingdom. He was the king. Other king, his father had been in town for 12 years. 10, 13 years. No, it's not.
Yeah.
I'm second, you'll be third.
It's that.
No.
Yeah, so there you go.
But that's not it. No. You understand? We know now from the canoe from hell that it was
group of third.
Okay. Now, I'm glad you asked that.
Well, so just wait. How you twitching for?
Now,
great tests.
That's right. Now, does it mean that they did not note this? Does it mean they could not read the words, the letters? Or does it mean that they knew the letters but couldn't tell what it meant? And was it written in Hebrew, which probably was, or Aramaic? Probably Hebrew. If the words in Hebrew, they would appear something like this. Now, your picture in the syllabus is not quite accurate. You see the little dots on there? Those are the vowel points. Those were not added about the time of Christ. They did not put those little vowel points. It would look something like this. Now, what probably is that they, possibly it was written in ideograms, but you see, they could read the words, but the words don't make sense. Without the interpretation, it's not a complete sentence. Understand? So I think being wise men, educated men, they could probably read the letters, read the words, but not read the sentences because it didn't make a sentence. You got my point? So without the interpretation, the words make no sense. Probably, it's probably what it means. We're not sure what it
what letters were written.
Exactly. Okay. Now, let's come to verse 10. The queen entered the banquet hall. Yes. I've heard that, but no, there's no indication of that in the text. They knew what it meant. You see, you understand what I'm saying? If they knew the words, they wouldn't know what they meant, what the message was. Then all the king's wise men came in, they could not read the inscription or make known its interpretation to the king. King Belshazzar was greatly alarmed. His face grew even paler, and his nobles were perplexed. What a way to kill a party. And the fun was definitely over. Here there's, now the hand apparently is gone now. The hand disappeared, I take it, after the, it was written. But here are these words up there on the wall. The queen entered the banquet hall. See, at least, where was she before? Well, you see, this banquet hall lasted several days. And she'd gone for a rest or whatever. The queen entered the banquet hall because of the words of the king and his nobles. The queen spoke and said, O king, live forever, as a standard greeting. Do not let your thoughts alarm you or your face be pale. There is a man in your kingdom, in whom is the spirit of the holy gods, in the days of your father, your ancestor. The illumination, insight, wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, was found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father, your ancestor, your father the king, appointed him the chief of magicians, conjurers, Chaldeans, and diviners. See, Daniel, where's Daniel? Why didn't he come in with the first crowd? He's not there. He's off somewhere. We've got to round him up. We'll find him. And obviously, he wouldn't be at this party. He would not find Daniel. He'd make a point not to be present for this pagan revival meeting. So she said, remember Daniel? Now, he's still around, isn't he? Daniel is a pretty old man by now. This was because of an extraordinary spirit, knowledge and insight, interpretation of dreams, explanation of enigmas, and solving of difficult problems were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belshazzar. Let Daniel now be something. He'll be fair interpretation. She remembered Daniel. Now, the queen was probably the mother of Belshazzar, not his wife, first of all. You got that? Belshazzar was not the direct son of Nabonidus. And Daniel had either lost his office, become obscure, or been engaged in business that kept him out of the attention of Belshazzar. Now, any of those possibilities. See, we're trying to explain why Belshazzar didn't know about Daniel. And, but keep in mind, a lot of years have passed. 606, when Daniel went into captivity, this is 538, a long time. Much could have happened, any one of these things. Then Daniel was brought in before the king, apparently in the city. The king spoke and said to Daniel, are you that Daniel who is the one of the exiles of Judah, and my father the king brought from Judah? And I've heard about you that the spirit of the gods is in you, and that illumination, insight, and extraordinary wisdom have been found in you. In verse 15, these wise men could not give me the interpretation. Verse 16, I've heard that you can do it. If you're able to read this inscription, the inscription, and make this interpretation known to me, you'll be clothed in purple, wear a necklace of gold around your neck, and you will have authority as the third ruler of the kingdom. The ruler of the third. Then Daniel answered and said to the king, keep your gifts for yourself and reward to someone else. However, I'll read the inscription and tell you what it means. Here's one thing. Wasn't Daniel sacrificial? Not really, because he knew what it meant. And the point is, Belshazzar wasn't going to have any kingdom to give anybody a third of after tonight. That's what I point that out to you. Daniel says, keep your gifts. Why not? You're going to be dead. And your king and the person are taking over. So he... Okay, and then he preaches a sermon. This was the point of Daniel. Now keep in mind, what had Nebuchadnezzar been doing when the hand appeared? Insulting the God of Daniel, the God of Israel. Then Daniel answered and said before the king, O king, most high God. Which God you say? The most high God. You mean the one I just love? Here's Nebuchadnezzar sitting there on his, laying there on his table. Here's Daniel on the other side of the table, telling him, and what's sitting on the table? That was the temple of the Most High God. They didn't use it to insult the Most High God. I can't read this, so it's different than my body. Like Daniel, when he's appearing before the king, the second, he points at the message. He says, can you picture that? Daniel says, the Most High God. The Most High God granted sovereignty, this God exalted grandeur, glory, majesty, and Nebuchadnezzar, your father. Because of the grandeur which he bestowed on him, all the people, it's the same thing. Verse 19, we've seen this theme before, have we not? The same lesson to Nebuchadnezzar, who was forced to live like an animal. You were king because God made you king. The God you've been insulting, he's the God who puts kings on the thrones and takes them off. Puts them on when he's ready and takes them off when he's ready. Not Marduk. You've been pleading with your gods to make Babylon great. They didn't make Babylon. But don't see the point? What was the whole point of that? What was the whole purpose of the banquet? To invoke the blessing, to quote the God, to make us great again. And Daniel is saying, look, these gods didn't make you great in the first place. You're talking to the wrong God. You want Babylon to be restored. But when his heart was lifted, and he tells about his ancestor, who lived like an animal. Verse 21, you've read this. Yet you, his son, his descendant Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, even though you knew all this. Part of the family history. But you have exalted yourself against the Lord of heaven. Understand that? You have exalted yourself. How have you done that? Very specifically, he had done it by taking the vessels out of the treasury and using it. Exactly what he's talking about. You see what I'm saying? He's not just saying you've done it in a general way. You've done it in a very specific way. Exalted yourself against the Lord of heaven. Look what he says. Look how Daniel says he's done it. And they have brought the vessels of his house before you, and they are on the table, and your concubines have been drinking wine from them. You have praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Do not, like all the prophets, they got their day again. But do not see, hear, and understand. Know how the thing reversed? Now Daniel is ridiculing the Babylonian gods. You talk about what to ridicule somebody. These are the gods that don't understand. Then the hand was sent from him, and this inscription was written out. Well, time's up. We'll pick it up there next time.